Sorry?
When is the celebration?
So today, as many, I think everyone knows, it's Columbus Day. And it's also the High Holy Day of Judaism, Day of Atonement. And for some people, it's the Indigenous People Day. I've been told that in Berkeley, the city of Berkeley does not celebrate Columbus Day, but rather celebrates today as the Indigenous People's Day. Because there are certain people who don't feel that Columbus is something to celebrate. Mostly the Native Americans, who Columbus, you know, was the, you know, was the advance party of a few or more people following him. It kind of took over the continent. Now, so I wanted to talk. I want to talk a little bit about this meeting of cultures, the meeting of perhaps indigenous culture, which probably say cultures, there's many different Native American cultures, and the so-called European culture as it came to America. And we have the you know, the Day of Atonement today, and at the very same time, this tremendous violence is happening in Israel and Palestine. And you know, two people who seemingly maybe can never live together in the same piece of land and are kind of destroying each other in the process. And we have, you know, in our own country, you don't have to go back very far to see that what some people call the genocide of the Native Americans here in the United States and North America. And genocide is a very strong word, and some people will feel, well, you know, that didn't happen here in this continent, no way. However, from whatever you think, there are some really amazing calls for genocide, public calls for it in American newspapers in the last century. And this is one. This was written, editorial written by the editor of the South Dakota Aberdeen Saturday Pioneer in 1890. And one of the things significant about this quotation, it was written 9 days before the massacre at Wounded Knee. The nobility of the redskin is extinguished, and what few are left are a pack of whining curs who lick the hand that smites them. The whites, by law of conquest, by justice of civilization, are masters of the American continent, and the best safety of the frontier settlements will be secured by the total annihilation of the few remaining Indians. Why not annihilation? Their glory has fled, their spirit broken, their manhood effaced. Better that they should die than live the miserable wretches that they are. So it was a call for genocide. That was 9 days before the massacre at Wounded Knee. 3 days after the massacre, 4 days after the massacre, the same editor wrote approvingly, "We had better, in order to protect our civilization, follow it up and wipe these untamed and untamable creatures from the face of the earth." So that's pretty strong language, a call for genocide in American history. So it's, I don't know how remarkable or how unusual that kind of statement is, but what's really unusual, and what really I think will probably surprise you, when you realize who wrote this, who that editor was. The editor of this piece, these two editorials, was the author of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Now, Wonderful Wizard of Oz is one of the great children's stories, the great myths of the 20th century. It was published in 1900. And so then what's happening? What's the connection between Frank Baum, these two Frank Baums who wrote The Wizard of Oz, the person calling for genocide, and the person who wrote The Wizard of Oz? And what's Frank Baum was interesting for other reasons. I don't know how many of you know something about his life. He started a magazine in about 1892 or 3 or 4, something like that, called something like the window display, the window displayer or something like that. And early in his life, he was into theater. He was an actor and was a kind of running around New England, I guess, performing in theater. He was also very interested in magic. And in the early 1890s, when he'd moved to Chicago, there was this huge upsurge of American production of consumer goods. And the big challenge was, how do you sell consumer goods? If you produce them, you have to have a market for them. And that was a big concern. If American economy was going to progress, it wasn't just simply a matter of making more. You had to make more consumers. And with his background in theater and his background in business, he realized that one of the things you needed to do was you needed to display your goods in store windows in a beautiful and appealing manner. Until him, people would stack all their wares in the window haphazardly, just all over there. And people would just kind of, you know, walk by and hardly notice what was there, perhaps. And he used his background in theater and in magic to create these beautifully artful store displays, window displays, that would grab people's attention, and people then would want to buy those things. And his magazine that promoted this art of window displaying was tremendously successful all over the, I don't know, maybe all over the country to send out subscriptions. So he was one of the important pioneers, perhaps, or founders or instigators of the consumer movement in the United States, in promoting consumption. One of the early advertisers. So what does this have to do with anything? One of the ways of reading The Wonderful Wizard of Oz is it's a consumer utopia. It was the Emerald City is a very interesting city, and the Wizard of Oz was a very interesting man. Maybe he was the perfect advertiser, because he didn't present himself. He was behind the curtain. And there's this wonderful, majestic, and beautiful, you know, sometimes majestic person, sometimes a beautiful woman in the book, takes a throne. But he's just a little guy behind the curtain who's kind of not really representing himself accurately. But when he's revealed, he's a little bit ashamed of himself, but he's kind of seen as a benign character. He's kind of forgiven and allowed to be the deceiver he is. And this is somehow the nature of advertisement. We're quite willing to kind of let advertisement kind of be a little bit deceptive. And this was the art of theater that Frank Baum was such a great master of. If you read, I don't remember what happens in the movie so well, but if you read the book, the Emerald City is taken to be the ultimate consumer capital. It says very clearly in the book that people are happy because all the goods they want are available there for them freely. So it's not, they're not happy because they have friends and they have great spiritual connection to whatever, or you know, or but rather all kinds of goods are available to them, and so they're happy. Frank Baum apparently wanted to create a vision for children that they could have desires and not be afraid. Now, isn't that a wonderful kind of producer's dream, to have people who could desire and not be afraid of their desires? So what's the connection with his editorials calling for the genocide of the Native Americans? The massacre at Wounded Knee in 1890 happened after a series of events. One was that the Lakota Sioux were banished to the Black Hills. They were given a treaty and given rights or ownership to the Black Hills for forever. In something like 1868. In something like 1874, they discovered gold in the Black Hills. Now, gold was a very important commodity that would help in the progress of the American economy. And so it became very important for the Europeans to have that gold to perpetuate the economy, because the American economy was beginning to really pick up steam in the 1880s, 1890s, to produce a lot of things. So the Lakota stood in the way of getting that gold. So that one thing led to another, and you ended up with a massacred Wounded Knee. In 1970, the same Black Hills of Lakota was discovered to have uranium and was discovered to have coal. And in 1973, there was a second massacre at Wounded Knee. Apparently, the largest deployment of military hardware in the continental United States, probably since the Civil War, was at Wounded Knee. Very small little place, a whole bunch of, kind of radical extremists, Native Americans, who claimed it. And America mobilized itself and shot it out up there. And the claim some people make is that it's not a coincidence that this happened only a few years after the discovery of uranium and coal, because this is what America wanted. American kind of the whole economy was beginning to gear up for energy. Energy was really important. So what you see, I think what we find, is a clash between a consumer culture and an indigenous culture, which is not really a consumer culture. And the consumer culture, I think, is one of hungry ghosts. And I think why it's partly why it's relevant to talk about in a sitting group like this. I thought it was noteworthy to listen to the first presidential debates this year. And the two candidates were talking about what to do about the oil reserves up in Alaska. And Gore has his strong opinion about leaving that alone. And Bush's point of view, the way I remember what he said very clearly, was he wanted the American consumer to go first. It wasn't the American citizen, it wasn't the American workers, it wasn't the American families. He said the American consumer should choose what's right, or I want to do what's right for the American consumer. The consumer has become, the ultimate arbitrator of what should happen with the environment, with the economy, and everything. So we've all become consumers in the eyes of some of the politicians, and certainly of Madison Avenue, and certainly a lot of corporations. And what consumers want is hungry ghosts. Because what hungry ghosts are people who, no matter how much you feed them, will always feel hungry. And that's the ideal consumer. But a lot of Americans don't want to have any questioning of their right to consumption. I mean, it's kind of it's kind of heretical in some circles to bring this up. It makes us very uncomfortable to feel, wait a minute, my right, I have God-given right to consume as much as I want or whatever I want. But is that the case? And what does it mean? The American economy? This was in the New York Times a few Sundays ago, a couple of Sundays ago. And I didn't know exactly this figure, but I trust maybe it's accurate. It claims that roughly half of the world's population, or about 3 billion people, belong to the category of people called the world's poorest people, those defined as earning $2 or less a day. $2 yesterday. That means that if you lived with your current lifestyle as you're living right now, but every other person in the world, you know, every other person in the world, you know, is poor this way, right? Since it's half the population. But if it was every other house on the block, and you lived, if you retained your lifestyle you're living now, that means your neighbors on both sides would be dirt poor. That's the way, you know, if it was all distributed kind of equally. And then this article here goes on to say, Congress is still practicing tough love. American foreign aid declined an average of 8% annually in the 1990s. The average American had $42 of his or her taxes devoted to foreign aid in 1993 and $32 in 1998, according to the World Bank. The United States is the stingiest rich nation, but aid declined in many European countries as they tightened their budgets for monetary union as well. $32 of your tax money every year goes to foreign aid. So I don't know, you know. So the Wizard of Oz. That's really amazing. So we talked about briefly last week the wonderful myth of in American culture, the yellow brick road that leads to the wonderful land of Oz. And the question of consumption. And the question of the source of consumption, what motivates our consumption, and are we willing to question that and look at that? What America, what Buddhism, both Buddhism and American culture puts a high premium on freedom. But it's a very different kind of freedom. Maybe I talked about this last week. I think that the freedom that America kind of was often focused on is freedom from. And a lot of it was motivated by freedom from slavery, which was a very noble thing to do. But then freedom from limitation. Buddhism puts no particular stress on freedom to do whatever you want. Freedom to do whatever you want. Rather, Buddhism puts a focus on freedom from compulsion. And that's a very different movement, because if you're free to act on your compulsion, from Buddhist point of view, you're not really free. But if you, I'm a little bit confused here, am I? So, if you're free to act on your compulsion, you're not really free. But if you're freed of your compulsion, then you're really free. So the Buddhism doesn't necessarily question consumption, as if consumption is all bad, being consumer is bad. But rather, Buddhism would have a critique and say there's right and wrong consumption. And we need to be able to look very carefully at that. And one of the ways we look at that is, what is the motivation for our consumptive choices? And are we acting out of compulsion? Are we acting out of real need? Is what we do is to satisfy our wants, or do we satisfy our needs? I think there's a tremendous focus in America on getting people's wants satisfied. At the same time, there's a lot of people in America whose needs are not met. And I think that's somehow a little bit skewed to have it that way. So we have this wonderful day of Columbus Day. And he managed to sail across the Atlantic at a time when no one else had done it, and at least from Spain. And and then with that came a dramatic transformation of this North and South and Central American continents. And we live here in the midst of, as we live here on this continent, I think, with the heritage of what has made it possible for us to live the way we live right now. The tremendous amount of destruction of the environment, of Native Americans, of immigrants, of women, of slaves, all kind of has built, kind of slowly, slowly put all the bricks together to create the level of wealth and prosperity we have today. And how often do we look back into the past to see how we got here today? And how often do we look into the future to get a sense of what are the consequences in the future if we continue this way, the way we are, unquestioningly? Buddhism and consumer culture have something in common. And this is a very important point, I believe, if I can explain it well. And that is, both of them have both of them focus on the present. The ideal consumer is only concerned about their desires in the present and getting them met in the present. The past has no bearing for the ideal consumer, and the future has no bearing on the ideal consumer. In Buddhism, in a kind of simple way of understanding Buddhist teaching, you're supposed to forget about the past and forget about the future and just focus on the present. But I think that mindfulness, if it's really going to be mature, has to be a mindfulness that actually takes into account reflections and thoughts about the past and where we've come from, and gives some consideration and thought about the future that we're going to. That mindfulness that is only present moment attentiveness, I don't think is enough for a wise life. And I think some Buddhists have ended up focusing so much on the present that they really haven't understood very well the interconnected nature of their life and how their life is actually intimately connected to a much wider world than just their breath or their own meditation, their own well-being, personal well-being. I believe that it's impossible to do Buddhist practice in the long run unless you're also doing it for other people. I think it's actually impossible that we actually discover who we are in the depths of who we are when we realize our tremendous sense of interconnectedness with others and begin taking some responsibility for that. I don't think there is any maturing of mindfulness practice unless we in some way begin taking responsibility for how our choices interact with the world around us. One of the lessons of the Wizard of Oz, you know, Frank Baum's life, is how easy it is for us to live in a vision of hope, a vision of utopia, a vision of our goodness, a vision of promise, and ignore the underbelly of racism, of damage that our life might be causing to others. And to think of this very central icon of American culture, the Wizard of Oz, having its underbelly of a call to genocide. And the call to genocide was, as he said here, so that we can protect our civilization. And protect our civilization for Frank Baum was to protect the consumer culture that he was one of the great founders of. So it's Columbus Day. And there's many ways to celebrate Columbus Day. So that was maybe an unusual talk. So I should give you a chance to respond. Please.
You just mentioned a bit about differentiating between our needs and our wants. And what came to mind was, we don't really need a lot. And the monks live quite contently, very little. Should we all just go be monks?
Maybe you should.
But I guess I'm saying that monks show that you don't need a lot. I'm just wondering how to take that comment and look at it wisely.
Well, I was a monk for a while. I'm not a monk now, so that is partly the answer to your question. I found it was very important for my experience as a monk. And one of the reasons it was important was to show me how little I actually needed to be happy. And I carry that with me as a reminder all the time. So that it's very easy to have desires. Desires are really cheap. They come like a dime a dozen, cheaper than a dime a dozen. And it's really easy for me to let go of them. It's really easy for me to do with very little. And I think a lot of that is because of the training I had as a monk. Spending months and months, years, months and months sleeping on a rolled up, sleeping on a rice straw mat. I didn't even have a mattress, and being quite comfortable. I've slept on cement, days on a time. Cement, hard cement, and it was, I could sleep. In terms of remember when I came back from my first time in Asia, and I came back to be the San Francisco Zen Center again. And so the first night back, for some reason, they're going to put me up in their guest quarters. And it was this really plush bed, high bed, plush bed and everything, and I couldn't make myself sleep in it. I thought it was kind of decadent. So they had a very, very thick carpet on, kind of rug, throw rug on the floor that was much softer than much of the stuff I slept on in Asia. So I said, why waste the dirtying up those linen for me? I'll just sleep here on the rug. So I'm kind of rambling here, but the point being that monastic training, for some people, is a very helpful training to show them how little they actually need. Because many people have the illusion that they need a lot in order to be happy, and need to get a lot of goods and a lot of things, and to have the training, to have experience of having all these things drop away, and see how actually radical little you actually need to get by from day to day, is, I think, very helpful. Yes? Yes.
Another interesting historical note that everybody's heard of the California gold strike and the Klondike strike. Nobody's ever heard of the Black Hills gold strike because it petered out in a very short time.
No. There wasn't much gold there?
No.
Yes.
As you were speaking, I was kind of thinking about the developments in China and this whole. And I guess the question is, how do we explain the attractiveness of this consumer culture phenomenon? There doesn't appear to be any indigenous widespread resistance to it in around the world, whether it's China or US or Brazil or wherever. It seems that in come the tentacles of this consumer concept, and like a cancer, it seems to take over a culture. Little resistance, like it seems like the Chinese on one's cell phones and the internet. I'm not picking on the Chinese, I'm just thinking about that as an example of this attraction for excess, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to explain it. Mm-hmm. It just seems to be out of how, what's your take on it?
I don't know how to respond to that, but to be sitting in our position, in my position, to be kind of the recipient of someone who's, I'm the beneficiary of a lot of prosperity. And so to sit on the top of the heap, in a sense, and to criticize the heap, is a little bit odd, awkward position to be in. So people who are very poor, they see not just simply consumption as being a good in itself, but they see it as a way out of their poverty. Yeah.
Comment on the then on the stinginess of foreign aid, as to say, I'm not sure that the foreign aid that's given out by our government is good, that it goes for the purpose of good, and that maybe the stinginess is actually good for the people for who it was intended, because always strings.
This is, can I quote managing director of the International Monetary Fund? He says, we have to tackle the selfishness of wealthy countries. I was surprised that the head of the IMF would say that.
Because the U.S. isn't paying a part.
Yes?
I think resistance to consumerism is not dead in this country, not entirely. Probably many people in this room live as frugally as possible under the circumstances, drive old cars when they don't need to, try to wear out their clothes before they buy new ones. I think it may be just somewhat hidden.
Oh, I believe.
It's visible, as we like to think.
Yes?
Would you say something a little bit more about what the state of mind is characterized by hungry ghosts? Where the position of what's above it and what's below it. So put it in perspective.
You mean what's below and above it and below it in terms of the Buddhist cosmology?
Yes.
Buddhist cosmology has claims that there's six realms of existence, five realms or six realms, depending on the system. And the human realm is just one realm. There's also the animal realm. And there's the hell realms, and there's the hungry ghost realm, and there's the heavenly realms where the gods live. And the way Buddhist cosmology works, we're all cycling through all these over lifetimes. And depending on your karma, you go either go to hell if you've done bad karma, or you go good karma, you go to the heavens. And certain karma gets you born as a hungry ghost. And hungry, if you primarily live a life of greed, then you end up, but you don't necessarily causing harm to other people. You don't go to hell, but you get reborn as a hungry ghost. And hungry ghost is a being who has a really big mouth and a really, really huge stomach, empty stomach, and has this throat that is so thin that virtually nothing can get down it. So no matter how much he tries to eat, that stomach never gets filled. So the hungry ghost always feels hungry. It's always grabbing and wanting more and more. So the state of mind, I suppose, is one of lack, feeling of insufficiency, and feeling there's some kind of lack or some kind of emptiness that needs to be filled. And some people, that lack or emptiness is loneliness. Some people, it's a feeling of being inadequate in some way or insufficient in some way. And so if it's a psychological need of insufficiency or psychological need to try to fill an emptiness within us, a loneliness within us, and we go outside and try to do that with goods and activity externally, it won't really satisfy the emptiness. What it might provide is some temporary ego gratification, or it might provide some temporary sense of pleasure, or it might provide some temporary sense of safety or control. But the underlying sense of lack or sense of inadequacy or sense of emptiness hasn't really been filled at all. It's kind of been coated over temporarily, sugar-coated in a sense. And so people who are always looking outside of themselves to fill that emptiness can never really fill it, and so the emptiness is always then perpetuating them to keep looking for more and more, and they're never going to be satisfied. And so that's... Yes?
The way I see it is a human being have a lot of like and dislike and stuff they want, and this stuff seems to make people's lives very conditional. If they have the stuff they like, or if they're in a situation or condition they like, you feel some joy, otherwise you have a lot of suffering. But thing is, all these conditions, all this stuff, all the situation, never say you have to like me or you don't have to like me. They never said you have to feel this way, you have to react this way, or you have to behave this way. They can't even talk.
Uh-huh.
But then somehow I think human beings make all this stuff up. So if we created all this stuff from nothing, how come so many people are suffering for nothing?
How come we all create our? You're saying we all.
I'm not asking a question.
It's a rhetorical question. Yes.
There's actually more to The Wizard of Oz. I think Frank Baum wrote that in about 1900.
Yes.
And it was a political allegory about monetary policy. And The Wizard of Oz was the head of the Republican Party in New York State, trying to get McKinley elected. And the Emerald City and the gold, emerald-colored glasses and all that were about Western East Coast banking policies. And the Cowardly Lion was William Jennings Bryan. The Tin Woodsman was the factory worker, and he had an axe with a silver handle and a gold blade, which was a code word for bimetallism, which the populace wanted. And the Scarecrow was the farmer. This whole thing's all, and the Wicked Witch of the West, some politician from Kansas and all that. And it wasn't a children's story when it was written. It was a very political allegory.
I know that theory, and I also know that it's not universally accepted theory.
Okay, cool.
Yes.
There are a lot of other words. I was actually pretty amazed at what he said about his character, because there's a lot of other ones that are very much greed is bad, there's the gnome king, and all sorts of stories about there's many jewels in his pocket, and the first out of his pocket, and then he doesn't have any more. Other stories of two races that live next to each other and hate each other, even though they're actually the same. There's a lot of things that would be very positive nowadays. So it's incredible that he wrote these editorials that are so awful.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, it's got a blind spot somewhere.
Well, one of the powerful lessons I took from this is that the degree to which we might have blind spots that we don't see. That, I mean, he was, from all accounts, apparently very nice, generous, sweet, kindly man. Most people seem to like him a lot, and he was married to the daughter of one of the great suffrage leaders, women suffrage leaders of the 1900s, 1800s, you know, and he was an ardent feminist, you know, and he dabbled in theosophy, you know, and all these kind of wonder, you know, interesting things, and probably studied, even read a book on Buddhism or two, I bet, back then. And so he was probably a very good person, but you know, all of us who are good can have something, you know, some blind spot. And the question is, for me, one of the questions for me is, how do we use our mindfulness to try to look really deeply at what our blind spots might be, what makes us tick, what are the fears, what are the reactions, what are the biases that that operate, that might be hidden. We might be blinded by our idealism sometimes from seeing this underbelly. And I believe that many of us here in America, and I include myself, I think many people in America have really beautiful qualities, really beautiful idealism. There's a lot of volunteerism in this country. There's a lot of donations to charities, and a lot of people concerned about community in many places. So there's a lot of really strengths to be celebrated and to talk about. But the question is, sometimes there's an underbelly to that. There's a hidden side to that. It's like when I went to the South, and the first time I went to the South in 1972 or so, I was actually frightened of going there because I was a long-haired hippie. And in fact, it was a little bit dangerous for me. I kind of, you know, was glad to. I had some close calls there, but I was really frightened because of the stories I heard, how hippies were treated there. And how blacks were treated in the South, the stories we heard. And it was shocking to me to go there from having grown up in Los Angeles to find that the Southerners, the white Southerners, were so much friendlier than the people I knew in Los Angeles as a whole. I mean, boy, they were so outgoing and friendly, and I couldn't meet nicer people who really wanted to help and had the time to help. And at the same time, some of these were ardent racists. So I think all of us are mixed bags, and part of what I think what Buddhist practice points to is a kind of very honest assessment of who we are and looking at ourselves that is not going to be critical or not going to be based on guilt, but rather some kind of realistic sense of what actually motivates us and what actually our biases might be, and then taking those into account. There's no space in Buddhist psychology for guilt. So liberal guilt has no role in at least Buddhism. But taking responsibility of ourselves is. So anyway, so I hope that this was something. and if nothing else, a little history lesson. Next time you go off to consume something, you'll reflect a little bit what it's like to live in a consumer society where the presidential candidate sees us as consumers before we are citizens. Thank you.